Media shouldn't be one note. Support Rabble.ca and a diversity of voices in Canadian media. Visit rabble.ca/donate to contribute.
Welcome. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. I'm in studio as per usual with Stefan Hostetter. How are you doing today, Stefan?
I'm quite well. How are you doing?
Great. I'm pumped because I have a very short list of people that I consider that I idolize to some degree, to a varying degree. But I'm pretty picky. You know this.
Oh, I do.
There's two people that I've talked about, Carl Sagan and of course, Dr. James Hansen. I always tell that story. Well, there's a third person who I think is just an exceptional human being and is doing great work. And it is our pleasure today that I'm actually a bit giddy. I was just telling you because we actually get to talk to him. So one of them is one of the best environmental journalists in the country. No reservations about that statement whatsoever. Mike D'Souza, who is a former Post-Media, Reuters, Toronto Star journalist, currently working for the National Observer, who has just been absolutely running a wrecking ball through the snooze regular media and just kicking up dust in the best possible way, standing up for citizens and exposing things that citizens need to know about. I'll stop short of calling it corruption in all cases, but in some cases there was definitely the appearance of corruption. But he is just doing an exceptional job, and it is my pleasure today to speak to him. I also say that by way of disclosure that this is not a neutral interview because I think Mike's great. So there we go.
You're not gonna really try to hardball in there?
No. When I say that so that people trust me when I say that I don't have a bias. In this case, I have a complete bias. Let's just put that right up front. I think Mike's great. We're gonna get to talk to Mike in about 15 minutes. But our guide for that 15 minutes is going to be you. Stefan, take it away.
That is true. So I get to begin the show with an update from last week. It's not too common. Every once in a while, we got to break a couple news stories last week, and we came so close for this one, I feel like. it was Saturday morning when this was announced, and so we would have had to, we'd have the first 24-hour show. We decided not to do that. by decided, I mean CIUT would never let us do that. So the news is that actually, so last week we reported on the HFCs, CFCs, all the different types of fluorocarbons, and specifically HFCs is hydrofluorocarbons. There was a big talk going on in – oh, man.
Oh. Are you having an Aleppo moment?
I'm having an Aleppo moment. And so, actually, I believe it's – I want to say Rwanda.
You're right.
It was nice. Rwanda. Then I'm not having an Aleppo moment. Yeah. I'm having a Rwanda moment, which is why I'm right about where the talks are happening. So the talks are happening there. It's with almost 200 nations. We're trying to have a conversation about reducing HFCs. Now, the thing about HFCs, of course, is that they are about 10,000 times more effective at trapping heat in the atmosphere than carbon. And so any reduction of any HFCs is monumentally more effective at limiting climate change than carbon. Now, of course, there's way less of these, but that's how this works, right? And so what's interesting is this one talk. So the good news, I've buried the lead here, but the good news is that they've come up to an agreement to actually limit and slowly reduce and effectively, by the end of this, eliminate HFCs from our ecosystem. That includes it's a long process. It doesn't actually begin until 2019, and then there's a sort of a scaling up of actions from different places. So basically the Western nations get to start 2019 to start reducing HFCs in their refrigerators and AC units by 2024. China and 100 developing countries come on board with that, and then a small group of countries, including India and Pakistan and some Gulf states, don't start reducing them until 2028. Because their economy, saying their economies need more time to grow, but the, you know, the, yeah, that seems like a long way off. But it should be noted that's actually 3 years earlier than India actually had proposed. So it's everyone sort of gave a little bit, and it seems like everyone's happy. It's one of these things where everyone seems relatively satisfied with this deal, which is fantastic. India's chief delegate came out and supported it. Even the small island nations, which are usually the ones that are sort of, you know, because they're the ones most at risk, usually come out and quite against it, or always pushing for more and more action because, you know, they're the first impacted. And so this conversation, there was a group of these small nations and some African nations as well that were sort of joining forces to be the really we need to reduce HFCs push, it's not exactly the exact quote here from Matlin Zakharis, the minister in assistance to the president of the Marshall Islands, said it may not be entirely what the islands wanted, but it's a good deal. Which, you know, at this point, as far as international policies go, that's pretty good. Not to mention, this one's binding. It's actually legally binding, unlike the Paris Accord.
Yeah. I think it's important that you put that note on there that taken into the account the fact that this is a, you know, international agreement that is law, you know, that is bound by law, that no one has ever said we got everything we want, unless we're talking about trade deals.
Yeah.
Right. Like, so
yeah.
Like I think that's a very minor qualifier. I think that's to be expected. I don't think a deal could be expected where, those who are the most risk averse, i.e. those who are the most at risk, i.e. the small island nations, were going to say, yes, we got absolutely everything we got. I don't think that was a reasonable goal. So yes, I think we can go ahead and just call this a win.
Yeah. And you know, if you have both the people being most impacted on one side, like either the government, like India, and the people who are, who obviously try to delay this as much as possible, okay with it, and the island nations who would be most impacted by the lack of action, okay with it. It's a win, everyone. We're going to own this win and celebrate it. So much so that Durwood Zielk, the president of the Institute for Governance and Sustainable Development, came out and said, this is apparently, in his words, the largest temperature reduction ever achieved by a single agreement. So, good news. Does this stop our need to contain carbon? No, but can we at least be happy that international talks, and look, diplomacy works, people. International talks actually might be a success. Interestingly, in the article, there was no mention of actually what we would be replacing HFCs with. So I don't know whether or not there's an attempt to contain them better, or if they're actually phasing them out of the usage. Mm. But I'm sure you could probably look in further and actually find what the next step is there.
Well, and what I think was really interesting about that is that, you know, I mean, we essentially got, okay, it's on one minor component of the issue that relates to climate change. But what's really interesting was that, I mean, you could take this and it's very easy to listen to what Stefan just said or read the article and go, blah, 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 blah. Okay, whatever. Yeah, deal, blah, blah. No. But like, here's the thing that you should be paying attention for, is that basically what was just described was we have a problem. We don't necessarily have an agreement on what the solution is, but we have an agreement on a binding thing that requires a solution. And we're going to let, you know, a combination of market forces and further legislation and local legislation to worry about the details. We're going to start with the principle that at the end of the day, this must be met. How we meet it will then be worked out based on the fact that you now have to meet it. That's an exact model for what we've been asking for the macro problem, which is climate change. And everyone says that's impossible.
Yeah.
Well, congratulations. You just proved that that's not the case.
Well, it is, you know, it points
like it's a model for how we need to approach the other problem. And it's just really funny that you can get it on a smaller part of it. But then when you take the exact same model to the larger problem, people go, oh, that's crazy.
Yeah. Well, it comes from the fact that when you're looking, you know, HFCs, while a major part of one particularly small industry, an ironic industry given that it's coolant, it's AC and refrigerators that these are most likely commonly used in, which, you know, climate change will make you need more of.
I'm actually seeing Ezra Levant's headline right now. Conspiracy exposed. Look at this. If the climate change is real, why would you try and be banning coolants? Gotcha, hippies.
You know what? I have no response to that. I'll give in. Moving to the next topic of news. Less fun story. And we don't cover these too often, I feel like. We sort of for a while, we are trying to cover most oil spills, and then we realized that's basically impossible. And so we gave up. But this is particularly of interest. It is the diesel spill that's off the BC coast, and the attempts to sort of actually keep it within its boundaries has been failing. They've been finding sort of oil outside of the containment areas, and they're, you know, it's just, you know, it's an ongoing effort, as all of these things are, and yet another reminder that. You know, you can say that nothing – you can say that it's safe until a tanker off the BC coast, you know, goes down, and then suddenly you have oil in your water. And, you know, it's a funny timing given the amount of ramping up of effort to get a pipeline that's going to go out to BC as that's ramping up. Like the fact that, and that's, you know, largely going to very, very likely will increase the amount of tankers needed to go to the BC coast, that a tanker carrying oil goes down and spills 10,000 ton tanker. And, you know, it's one of those things where it's like you can keep saying it's mostly safe, but if you run 10,000 tankers through there, even if it's 0.1% safe, like even if only 0.1% of all tankers go, you know, will spill any oil, if you run 10,000 tankers through a space, that means there will be oil on those shores eventually.
Well, and that's one of those things I want to – I have two quick comments about that, actually. Yeah. One of the things I want to talk to Mike about is I've done a sort of very armchair look at – we did a show a few weeks ago, and probably – I mean, you could probably rename subtitle one out of every four of our shows, you know, the true cost of oil.
Yeah.
It was explicitly the title of the show a few weeks ago. And this is me doing sort of armchair napkin math on – okay, well, you think it's this, and so we're being told it has this value, but really, I know that's not true. I don't know what the true number is because I don't have, you know, enough money to go and do a proper research project here, but I can tell you that the number you're being told is wrong because it doesn't account for this, right? And so one of the things that I'm going to talk to Mike about is about that very thing, about the true cost of oil, and one of the things that never gets fed into the price of the gas pump, or how valuable this is for Canada as an industry, is the fact that regardless as to whether or not the oil goes into your gas tank or a gas tank in China or a gas tank in wherever, is the fact that if it spills here, we pay for it. And sure, the company might pay for part of it. In many cases, they pay for some of it, but not very much of it. In several cases, and I don't have the exact number, but it's quite hard to look up. You might be shocked to find out. But in many cases, the Canadian public has paid for almost all of a disaster spill, or it simply isn't dealt with at the time. And then we get a secondary effect. So something like the Mount Polly disaster that poisons a bunch of water, that kills a bunch of fish, and then kills an industry, or perhaps takes the food source away from a First Nations group that now needs to apply for more funding from the government. So like these are all knockdown events that are never, ever calculated into the cost of oil, right? So if you took the price of every single subsidy, added that to the price of every single oil spill that the Canadian public had to pay for, added that to all of the knockdown effects, all of the downstream effects, there's no chance this makes us any money. And if I'm wrong, then great. I'd like somebody who's an advocate for the oil industry to go and do that math. Show me that I'm wrong. But I would put every dollar that I have, which I admit is not much. I can maybe spare about $7.50. But I will put it down.
$7.50.
I will put it down as a statement that there is not a chance that this is a good deal for us when you actually do that math.
Hmm.
And the thing is, and that's what's so shocking about it, is that even the math, I mean, we covered a few weeks ago, even the math that's covered in the mainstream media, in traditional news sources, we're even saying, yeah, it's pretty close. And those pretty close numbers they're talking about like this is arguably, you know, there's a reason why companies are on the fence about their investments and all this stuff. None of those numbers taken into account anything I just said. So I'm pretty safe in being certain that this is a losing proposition for us if somebody actually did the actual math.
Well, and like this is the thing, this difficulty of having this kind of conversation is what I struggle with all the time, which is that when you want to have an argument or a conversation with someone, you both have to have a similar premise. And if the premise that science is telling us is that no new oil infrastructure can be created because we already have reserves that blow past our carbon budget, I struggle to have a conversation with anybody else who doesn't accept that one premise. You know, I can change my premise, but if that's the premise science is demanding, how do you have that conversation? How do you expand this? How do you expand your tent when the central point that you are trying that you that 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 science has shown is true is being rejected by the rest of the people who are in this conversation.
Well, and my favorite thing, like, and one of the other articles I flagged for this week was about how, official denialists, like denialist groups and denialist funding groups, are sort of finally starting to kind of waver in their impact, and they're more and more of the public, and even governments that really want to believe that it's true, are either less willing to, less able to, or just don't believe this stuff anymore. But the remaining stuff, I have the exact opinion about it that I do about Donald Trump, which is that it would be hilarious if it wasn't so freaking terrifying. Which is that, like, every single thing, look, climate change isn't real. Basically, throw out what all these experts are telling you. What's your argument as to why we shouldn't trust them? And all they do is they cherry pick quotes from those very scientists. So even if we throw out the idea that they're being completely dishonest in their arguing tactics, which is taking data out of its context and presenting it in a completely misleading light, is that your source material is still the scientists that you said were not trustworthy. Like, who is that stupid? And I don't think it's stupidity. I think it's that people just really aren't paying attention, combined with how many people want it to be true. They want it to be not true is the answer. But it's really hard to look at that and not think that most people are complete idiots, though that isn't the case.
Right. Well, that's the central problem with the new form of denialism that we see. Like, the new denialism isn't actually saying that climate change isn't real. The new form of denialism is saying climate change is real, but then not doing anything about
it. The so-called lukewarmers.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, fine.
Or not even lukewarmers, but, like, if right at this current moment, the number of people who just sort of accept climate change is a real thing, but don't agree about the timelines, like, that's the same thing. It's not useful to, you know, if your plan to address climate change would get us to carbon neutral by 2200, you might as well be denying it. It doesn't actually change anything. It just makes it harder for those of us who are actually trying to push forward real policy on the correct timelines. Like, as soon as you start arguing timelines, like the difficulty we already face getting make climate change salient. Like, you know, you mentioned Donald Trump. There were four debates. Three presidential, one vice presidential. Not a single – the closest you got to a question about climate change was a question from a weird man in a red sweater who asked about how you would be able to be more environmentally friendly while preserving jobs for people working in fossil fuels. And that's the closest to a question. And that wasn't from the moderator. The moderator never asked a question about this.
Yeah, that was a town hall. Yeah.
So, like, at this point, you're looking at – how, like, we're already struggling to get this issue to be in any way salient, like, to have anyone talk about it. Like, the fact that four debate moderators all chose questions and none of them decided to ask one question about climate change. And then to switch that from not only having to ask questions, do you believe in it, to what are the timelines you want to have to act on it, is a massive step to even have this conversation. And what's ridiculous, of course, is that, like, everyone's is now clearly agreeing to what's happening. The fact that we've now had two major worldwide agreements in the last year to fight climate change, clearly the world accepts it's happening, and yet our discourse still acts as if it's not. And we're going to have to figure out some way to deal with this.
Yeah. And while we're making – before we go to our first music break and come back and talk to Mike D'Souza, I can't resist making one more Trump comparison. Now that I'm significantly less terrified about him actually becoming president, I feel like we have a safe space now to have some more fun.
We have 3 weeks where he's both – we have to – we can still pay attention to him but also be less scared that he might become president.
Yeah. Now I want to make sure that when I say this, I don't mean this in a jesting way, and that I'm not sort of trying to make light of a very serious conversation. I mean this as an extremely serious comparison. Just so that nobody misunderstands that I'm making light of something quite serious. But I mean, this is like when, you know, people were saying, oh, Trump didn't say those comments about, you know, sexually assaulting women with reference to the, well, climate change isn't happening.
Right.
And now, like, this is how stupid and how hideous you are for saying, okay, it's true, but, you know, okay, it's all real, but we don't need to do anything about it. Is you're essentially you're the equivalent of people like Ben Carson who are saying, yeah, okay, he did do that stuff or he did say that stuff, but it's not really a big deal.
Yeah.
That's how hideous you sound. That's how hideous you look. And that's how stupid you look, just as stupid as Ben Carson, because I'm sure any of those people are listening. But we're going to come back and talk to somebody who I would say is much more of an actual journalist than we are. I consider us commentators. You know, some people have said, well, you're technically still journalists. Okay, fine. But an actual real bona fide journalist would be with us.
A real live journalist. Yay. Yes.
A real live journalist could come on in just a minute. So, and as I did say, I got surprised again this week. You may have noticed I haven't thrown to Alex yet. We don't have a tech this week. And unfortunately, the first casualty of us not having a tech other than me is that we're going to have to listen to dance music. So here comes Ghosts and Stuff with Dead Mouse. If you have a better suggestion for music you would like to hear, tweet at Stefan right now. For our second and final music break, because I still haven't picked it, you can do so. That's at @Steho_, and you can tweet him. And if not, Stefan will make up the second music break. So
all right, done.
We'll be right back with Mike D'Souza. Here's some Deadmau5. All right, you are back. That was, as I said, some Deadmau5. If you loved it, you're welcome. If not, tweet Stefan right now at @Steho_ to get a better selection on our next music break. But without wasting any more time, let's just confirm, because this is the first time I've actually done my own phone call. Mike D'Souza, are you there?
I'm here. How are you?
Nice. I nailed it. Good. I'm just thrilled I got you on the phone. Let's deal with that first. So just as a brief bit of context, so Mike D'Souza, you have been a journalist for quite some time. I've been following you as a unwitting contributor to our show through your environmental career, through when you were working at Post Media, and probably not as much with your stint at the Toronto Star, but it was really funny because immediately when I started reading your articles years and years and years ago, and we had you on the show maybe like 4 years ago, I remember the first few times I read some of your articles, and it was the content was so different than what I was reading on the same website from another journalist on the same website, that I remember somewhat jokingly thinking to myself, there's got to be a clock ticking on this guy, because you just seemed so much more. I hesitate to use the word activist, but you just seemed so much more concerned with a very pointed form of investigative journalism that to me stood out. It was quite obvious to see that you were a different breed than the other people there. When you left, I was quite shocked. So tell us a little bit about that story.
I would say there's a clock ticking on all journalists right now, given the state of the media. What might make me different, I mean, I wouldn't use the word activist, but what's important to me is asking tough questions all the time, not accepting standard lines from anyone, whether it be in government or industry. If they don't want to answer a question, I'm going to ask it again until they actually answer. And I think most people know that about me by now, that I even if I don't get that answer initially, I will dig as hard as I can to get those answers. But that's what's important to me as a journalist. I think there are a lot of other journalists that do approach their job in this way, but given the state of the media, the cuts that have happened, widespread across many different media outlets, there's fewer and fewer journalists that are able to dedicate that kind of time to do this type of work. And right now I'm with National Observer. We're dedicated to that, and I'm quite happy that I have this opportunity right now to pursue this type of investigative journalism.
So before we get a little bit into specifically why we asked to be on the show today, which was the relationship with the Post Media now several years on, I wanted to just ask, for the sake of context, there's been a number of stories about journalists covering environmental stories. I have a couple here flagged. One was Amy Goodman, who was initially charged with criminal trespass and then was charged with something having to do with inciting a riot or participating in a riot. That we just found out this week, that charge has been dropped. But there's another reporter who's contributing on a documentary with Josh Fox, Dia Schlossberg as well, who's currently still facing charges as well. What is going on? What's going on? I'll leave it there.
That's a really good question. I think in a lot of these cases, some of the work that journalists are doing is exposing inconvenient facts or phenomena or issues that some powerful people don't want to see brought to light, and they're not comfortable with that. So there's an aggressive reaction. And I guess it's a bit disproportionate. It's unusual whenever you see someone who is trying to suppress freedom of speech, who is trying to suppress journalists from doing their jobs. We should never stand for that. It's not, we don't live in North Korea. We don't live in the former Soviet Union. We live in North America, in the Western world, and in democracies. So I think it's important for journalists to stand up for their right to ask questions, their right to report and provide the public with information that the public needs to make good decisions, to provide decision makers with the evidence they need to make good decisions, and, you know, in the same way, just to help society as a whole make progress and find the right ways to go forward and make society better.
Mm-hmm. Well, and that's one of the reasons I couched my activist at the beginning, and I agree with you that you're not, but the reason I chose to use that word, and I agree with you that you aren't, but it is how the mainstream media is essentially framing anybody, I would say, that it is doing any sort of journalism that doesn't toe that line, that doesn't go, okay, well, you know, we have to be concerned about our advertisers or whatever it might be, and that activist is simply being used as an attempt to smear journalists who aren't sort of towing that line of, hey, okay, at the end of the day, we have to be nice to all these folks because, you know, because they're the rich and powerful or whatever.
Well, I mean, people can, people are free to criticize, you know, in the same way that journalists should be free to pursue investigations of public interest. People are free to criticize, and you know, if they wanna put labels on people, that's their choice. You know, I hope that the public is smart enough to recognize when someone is crossing a line and is, you know, instead of looking at the issue, they're trying to find a distraction to avoid talking about the issue. You know, I try to stay focused, and the rest, you know, along with my colleagues at National Observer, we try to stay focused on the issues, and we don't want to get distracted. I mean, you know, maybe we did get a bit distracted by having to respond to some of these issues ourselves in the past couple of weeks, but we're trying to stay focused on the important work that we're doing.
And so let's take that as a little bit of a lead into the National Observer story and your sort of story. There's two articles in particular that flagged this issue recently. One of them was put out by person who runs the newspaper as well, Linda Solomon Wood, talking about another journalist who works for National Observer going after the Irving family. Mm-hmm. While going after, I mean, you know, doing journalism about and their response.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Do I still have you?
Yes.
Sorry, I just heard a bit of a buzz there. And your question about...
Well, and just how this sort of ties to, yeah. I mean, the fact that anybody who does, this isn't simply a matter of, you know, other counter arguments being put out in the mainstream media. I mean, these people are sort of contacting, you know, whether the articles themselves are correct or not, the idea that someone would contact you and basically threaten you and say, hey, don't write that article because I don't like it. I think that a lot of people think that stuff doesn't really happen, but it does.
Well, to a certain extent, I mean, I've been working in the media for more than 15 years now, and you will get feedback on positive and negative stories. There are different levels of what happens. You know, sometimes you might have different people have different approaches to media relations. Some are more friendly and try to spin reporters, and others take a more aggressive approach. So, for example, I think it was well known that in the past decade in Ottawa, I guess up until November 2015, there was a different government in Ottawa that took a very aggressive approach to media relations, where it would publicly attack a journalist. And behind the scenes, it would be placing calls, you know, to high levels of different media organizations whenever there was a journalist that they didn't like. So, yes, that does happen. I guess it's part of the job. And, you know, part of it is reasonable. Part of it is if there's a journalist out there that crosses the line or that goes too far or that is not being fair, then certainly people have a right to criticize and ask questions about what that journalist is doing and, you know, if they've made mistakes, if they're not acting in a responsible way. But on the other hand, if the journalist is doing his or her job, and the end goal is to bully and intimidate, well, we have to speak up about that, and we have to denounce it, and we have to fight back.
All right. Well, speaking of fighting back, I'd like to take this opportunity now that we've sort of set the stage to retell part of the story. You wrote a little longer than normal, but I think worth every portion, or very, very important for context, our article about what's been happening now, was specifically with the article by Vivian Krauss titled "The Cash Pipeline Opposing Canadian Oil Pipelines." Can you recount that story for us briefly?
Yeah, so there's an opinion piece that was published in the Financial Post a couple of weeks ago that talked about the coverage that National Observer did on the Energy East pipeline hearings, the coverage we did that led to the adjournment of the hearings that exposed a potential conflict of interest that went up to the highest levels of the National Energy Board, including touching the chief executive, who was forced to recuse himself from any dealings with Energy East, and then that forced all the panel members on that as part of that hearing process to recuse themselves as well. So she decided to write a piece that looked at funding that National Observer had received before I joined the publication. And we felt she went about this piece in an irresponsible way. She didn't tell us that she was going to be writing a piece. She didn't tell us that she was going to be writing a piece for the National Post. And when we offered, or when I offered, to answer her questions, she didn't want to take that opportunity and preferred instead to write that I hadn't answered questions. So all those things we felt were irresponsible. Reflected or demonstrated a very, very poor judgment on the part of the editorial people at the National or Financial Post. It was irresponsible, pure and simple. And I thought it was disgraceful that this kind of piece was portrayed as fair and responsible journalism and made to look like a news piece that suggested that, that any reporting we're doing is linked to funding. So that was the piece, and we chose to react and defend ourselves. And I guess you've seen both pieces by now, and we'll see what happens from here. We filed a complaint with the press council, the National News Media Council, to have it look at this issue, and we'll see how they review and what they decide.
Well, and one of the things that really stood out for me, because I also read the linked article that Vivian wrote, and one of the things that really stood out for me was, the entire thing was in an extremely long, hey, basically, don't trust this journalist and be very suspicious of the publication for which he's working, because look where they're getting their funding. Now, there's a whole bunch of problems with that, I'll just say that if you want to sort of learn more about the details about why that was incredibly misleading, just to please to read the article, I'll link to it in the show post. The part I wanted to ask you about, though, was the idea that, I mean, she seemed to be saying that, you know, don't trust this journalist because, you know, they get some money from here. And in my position, maybe you don't agree with me, but to me, like, where somebody gets their money from is only relevant if there's something wrong with what they're saying and you're trying to find out why, right? So if we have somebody who's lying and I say, okay, well, these are easily refutable lies, why would they do that? Are they simply wrong, or is there something else at play here? Then you sort of look up, oh, I see this person's getting millions of dollars from the oil industry. They're writing a whole bunch of easily refutable, to someone who does their homework, the comments about, you know, pro oil. Therefore, this explains why they've been so, you know, bad. Essentially their job, just to make it really simple, then I think it's relevant. But I mean, if Donald Trump or whoever, you know, writes a hit piece and there, or somebody writes a hit piece and it, you know, is attacking Hillary Clinton, but everything in it is true, I don't think the fact that the money came from Donald Trump is relevant. Do you?
Well, you know, funding can have an influence. I think in a lot of cases it can. I think, you know, disclosure is good. I mean, in a lot of cases, but, you know, in terms of the media, media outlets have been getting advertising dollars from a wide variety of different advertisers, corporations. This has been going on for decades, and I don't know if we need to start disclosing disclosing more of this or not, but I think media outlets have clear or should have clear policies that separate the money that's coming in from the editorial decisions that are made. That's what we do at National Observer. If we have any arrangements with a foundation, there is an explicit agreement that says that we retain all editorial control. There's no direction. But you know, there can be problems with some of these funding sources, I think, at times. When it comes to a think tank that is promoting denial of climate change science, if we trace back that it's getting funding from one particular corporation that has financial interest in doing this, well, I think that can be interesting for people to know. Mm. So, I mean, you know, there's a bunch of different ways to look at this, but at the end of the day, I mean, looking at the issues, focusing on the issues and the substance of issues is, you know, the most important thing to do. A secondary thing is looking at the sources and what's driving things. But, you know, looking at it in a balanced way, in a responsible way, is what's key here. And unfortunately, this isn't always the case in terms of, you know, the stories we see about funding sources and links to messages.
Unfortunately, we are out of time, Mike, but I just wanted to take one last comment from you about the idea that, I mean, it could be very easily what I'm about to say could be very easily mistaken for just sort of a pale pitch for like, hey, these guys are great, give them money. But like, really from a point of view, like the mainstream media, as you said at the very beginning of the interview, the traditional media is just bleeding money. They're, you know, cutting jobs everywhere. All the major newspapers are going. And there's a numbers of reason for that. We've talked about it before. We don't anywhere near have enough time to get into why that is. But the reality is that they are. And what's unfortunately happening is that even though a lot of these traditional media sources do have a lot of problems, and I think their motives can be very suspect and all of that stuff, that they do produce a lot of primary reporting. Right. And so if they aren't doing it, we need people like you to do it. Or if people don't like you or they don't like us here at the Green Majority, fine, somebody else to do it. But like somebody needs to do it. And so if we're in agreement, and I'm talking to listeners here, that the traditional media is not serving its intended purpose, which is, you know, keeping a check on power to inform individuals so that we as citizens can make informed decisions about our government and about our life. Then we have to be willing to that we have somebody has to pay for it. And if you want the advertisers to pay for it and thereby have their interests protected, then great, you know, keep buying the National Post. But if you want your interests protected, whether it's, you know, Mike D'Souza, National Observer, us, or, you know, Rebel Radio or whoever it is that you like, I think people just have to get used to the idea that even if it's a couple bucks a month, wherever that money goes, that you're going to have to just be willing to if you're not paying for it, someone else will. And I think that people just need to get used to that idea of if they want to have journalists out there looking out for their interests, they're going to have to be willing to cough up a little bit of money for it.
Yep, that's a good point. I think, you know, people should be supporting organizations like or your show at the Green Majority. I think people should seriously think about subscribing and paying. I mean, people pay $30, $40, $50 a month for a smartphone, maybe $70, $80 for internet. Well, maybe it's time they start thinking about what information comes through those services. Do they want to just keep paying for a phone service and a smartphone that's blank? What content will they read if they're not supporting journalism? So I would agree with what you said. Please support journalism, and we need everyone to start stepping forward and helping.
Yeah, if you just bought a new iPhone to read National Post articles, you're wasting your money.
No comment.
Thank you so much. It's been really my pleasure, Mike, to have you on the show today. Thank you so much for your time.
Thanks for the invitation.
Absolutely. Have a great day. All right. So we'll be back here on the Green Majority in just a minute. That was Mike D'Souza, one of my, my favorite Canadian journalist outside of Stefan, obviously, here on the Green Majority. We're going to be right back. We do have a listener. That's how you know it's my first time taking a phone call. We do have a listener requested song now. We're going to be listening to The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIET 89.5 AM, possibly on our podcast, which has a bonus show coming up as well at the end of the program, and on our friends over at Rebel. Rebel. That was a good one. Rabble.ca, not to be confused with Rebel. coming up in just a minute. This is The Revolution Will Not Be Televised. We'll be right back here on CIUT. All right. You're listening to The Green Majority here on CIUT 89.5 FM. That was Mike D'Souza, who we just finished speaking to before the music break. And we are going to now talk a little bit more about journalism and a couple of more news stories. But I just, you know, as an attempt to resist talking about it on every show, we're going to take this opportunity to just sort of make this a very journalism-focused episode. So, Stefan, I didn't give you a chance to jump in on the interview. Did you have any follow-up comments?
Yeah, I think it's interesting talking to anyone who's really trying to actually make a living in this field. I think that's the perhaps the most remarkable thing about what National Observer is trying to do. Forget anything else, but just trying to actually survive and make it your life. Like, you know, what we spent a year trying to do that and eventually gave up and got real jobs.
Yeah.
Like it's a very difficult field, especially right now. And I think what's interesting is the amount of effort currently going into all the different looks and solutions to what the new version of journalism is. You know, everyone sort of talks disdainfully of sort of the old way of doing journalism, whether it's, you know, buy my newspaper or care about my app. And sort of when you look at sort of the numbers across, especially Canada, some of the numbers across Canada are shocking. Like the percentage of Canadian media owned by one or two companies wouldn't be allowed if it was anything but media. You know, if 95 or something, it's something ridiculous percentage of newspapers are all owned by Post Media. So if 95% of all cell phone towers were owned by one company, we break up the monopoly to be broken up, and yet journalism, because it's, you know, it doesn't count in that way, and so you're looking at this. You know, and what, like, you know, every couple of weeks I feel like there's a new story about number of journalism being cut or being moved in a different way. And so, like, it's a fascinating place to be in right now. You know, similarly, actually, journalism is similar to sort of a similar, you know, situation as the world is to some extent, which is that it's getting to a crisis point, whether it's climate change or trying to find how to make money in journalism, and in that sort of urgency is creating all these fascinatingly different attempts to make it work.
Right.
And you look at the De Correspond or some of the other stuff coming out of, for some reason, I think it's Denmark from De Correspond. It was a Holland. This one country, I think it's Holland, has like three of the most innovative types of doing news all came out of it at the same time. It's like they were just like, we'll figure this out, guys, and then export it other places. Mm. And so some of the solutions you're seeing there are fascinating, but it hasn't happened yet here. And I think we're on the verge of really trying to figure out and trying to understand what Canadian media looks like going forward.
Well, and back, and that's currently not where we're at right now, but back when the intention was, okay, throw everything at trying to make this a thing that we do, and then I realized that was really hard to do when we won't take anyone's money. But, you know, back when, as you were saying, you know, a little while ago, a couple of years ago, when we were like, okay, let's try and make this a thing, as like a full-time, all-the-time thing, one of the things that occurred to me was like, okay, good. I remember covering a story, or I read the story anyway, about how I think it was either Greenland or Iceland. I'm pretty sure it was Iceland. Basically passed the most progressive journalism protection laws in the world. They basically said that I don't remember it in explicit detail. I'm just going from memory here. But they passed something essentially that, aside from a bunch of other protections for whistleblowers, they also said that, you know, if someone wants to get into our country or is in our country as a journalist and they are being sought as extradition for something related to their journalism, that this excuses us from our extradition treaties and that we will refuse to extradite them. So basically it's like, if you're a journalist and you're pissing people off, come to Iceland. And I was like, okay, backup plan solidified. Backup plan is now moved to Iceland. but I mean, it's, yeah, I mean, and sort of this, the whole state here is that, you know, the traditional media is in the middle of cannibalizing itself, because, you know, and one of the things that I covered that I had flagged for this week was another more recent 20% cut to Post Media. Post Media, just to remind everybody, despite all these losses and despite their massive, massive losses and the fact that they're in crazy debt versus their income, they're firing people left, right, and center. There's a whole bunch of employees that have an option to either have pay cuts or sort of take a, you know, phase you out of having a job deal that they just offered recently, is that these companies, and or this company in particular, still had the power a year ago a little over a year ago to put pro-conservative ads on the front of 96% or something like that of the newspapers across the entire country. And I mean, it's no wonder, you know, we're looking at this sort of anti-intellectual thing when it comes to like Trump and when it comes to Brexit and this whole like, hey, well, you guys have been telling us, you know, all the answers for a really long time and you've been getting it wrong because you keep telling me you're going to help me. And then what I feel is being hurt. So it's sort of like, we'll throw the bums out sort of mentality that people have, which is a reference to elections where, you know, unless things are really great or unless there's the middle of a crisis, that a lot of the time it doesn't matter who's actually at fault. The response of the populace is just to throw out whoever the sitting government is, whether or not they're actually responsible or the best suited to deal with the problem is irrelevant. It's just this sort of reaction to like, okay, get rid of them. And so what's the problem is that a bunch of people in power who've been lying to people for all this whole time or, you know, being creative with the truth, let's say, to benefit themselves and their rich buddies, people know, the people have caught on, even if they don't know exactly why or how it's happened, that the people in charge are not favoring them. But unfortunately, they grouped all of the people on, in most cases, I'm struggled whether to call them activists, lefties, or neither, or if there's a better term. There should be a better term, but just for lack of one, you know, a bunch of hippie environmentalists, for example, when we're talking about the environment, and say, oh, we're going to group you in with all the, you know, corrupt elected officials that say that we shouldn't do what you say, and sort of throw all of you out, and just to go for the lowest common denominator, people like Trump, people like, you know, voting for Brexit, all of this stuff. And it's super dangerous because it's like, well, the sitting, you know, the powers that be, the corrupt, the powerful people don't want to listen to us being the environmentalists. And yet when they screw the general public over, we also get, you know, we get ignored again. Right. So it's either you trust them and they're telling you that we're wrong, or you don't trust them and you still don't think we're right. But it just makes me so insane. But I mean, this is population dynamics, right? Person is smart, people are stupid en masse. If people don't have time, and that's not, they're actually stupid, just they're objectively looking at their decisions. They vote against, people vote against their own interests all the time, because they're misinformed. It shocks me that there's not more of an acknowledgement of the importance of independent journalism and the separation of corporations from journalism. This is one of the motivating factors about why I've been doing this show for almost 10 years. And to quote a line from one of my favorite movies, I feel like I'm taking crazy pills. I don't understand how nobody else notices this.
Well, I think what's so funny about this is I think there's actually, I think saying support for independent journalism is like a catchphrase that everyone can get behind. You know, it's like, yes, that is a thing they should do. We should support this kind of journalism. But then you get immediately but then there's cash flow problems. And I think the cash flow problems is the most fascinating problem here, because of the fact that, you know, as these even larger and larger companies start, you know, needing to find the ways to make money, then you start getting into these just completely murky areas of things, you know, like content that sort of, you know, sponsored content in the middle of your magazine, which is, you know, oh, you wrote a piece about like 8 ways to use Axe body spray, but just happened to be a thing, definitely not funded by Axe body spray. As soon as you start merging that line between what is advertising, what is journalism, and of course, you know, people will often say things like, oh, well, but you know, like a fashion section and the car section are already basically ads anyways. What does it matter if we make them actually ads? And you know, I'm not going to – whether or not you want to believe, whether or not – you know, do I want my car to be bought by an advertisement, or do I want someone to actually be, you know, reviewing a car? I don't know. I personally probably want you to – you know, if I was bought a Volkswagen in the last 10 years, I'd like real reporting on cars, please. But you know, there you go. Or like, you know, using a more recent example, if I was going to buy a Galaxy X7, I would not want to hear Google's latent advertising for that. I would want to know it's going to blow up if I don't turn it off correctly. That's information I need to know. Whether or not it's in the technology section or not, I need that reported in a way that is reasonable.
Yeah. Or to make another example, it's just all these cases of right problem, wrong solution. Right. And to give another example, and I'll put the same qualifier on this that I did when we briefly talked about Israeli politics, which is, if you email me about this, I will ignore you because I don't care. But when it came, another example with journalism would be the issue of Gamergate, which is, there is a legitimate problem with game companies paying for game reviews. The response? women suck. Let's hate on women and terrorize them, and let's blame all women for this and make this a male-female thing. No, you were so close. There's a legitimate problem with corruption in the journalism industry, and there's a microcosm of that in the gaming industry. The solution to that is not to hate on women and terrorize them and give them death threats, you idiots.
Right, yeah.
It's so hideous, but the thing is, like, people are so close, and it's the same thing with all these politics. Yes, the politicians are lying to you. The thing, though, you need to pay attention is who isn't. And instead of that, it's just I'm just going to lash out at whoever is a victim, whoever is easy to pick on, instead of actually thinking about how do I solve this problem.
Well, I think almost every one of these sort of major intractable problems comes down to some sort of inherent tension that exists in the world. You know, so like this sort of thing between, well, everyone wants the populace to be informed, but everyone is busy and doesn't have time to read everything. So we try to inform them on sound bites, but then the sound bites don't accurately inform them, and so we don't have an informed populace. And it's this tension between how do you get a majority of people to read long-form journalism, and you probably won't. Although there's been some interesting studies that long-form journalism actually, as far as people willing to pay for it, that's what people want to pay for. And things like The Correspond, which I did check, is Dutch. So I was right about that one too. Two Rwandan moments, which are not Aleppo moments. these are these pieces that are – these tensions that exist all over and over and over again. Mm. You know, how do you fund a media company that does not in some way bring into question what you're writing? The easiest answer is public funded. Whether or not it's through a patron count or a subscription model like National Observer is running, or it's the CBC, publicly funding, at the very least, if I am paying for it, I know that their interest is keep me listening.
Right.
Now, of course, that can lead to sort of other things, you know, like BuzzFeed, which is will sell me 17, will then try to send me clickbait. But it's been proven that actually people don't really want that as much.
Right.
Or at least won't pay for it. We might click it, but we won't pay for it, which is an interesting tension again there. And so there aren't these solutions exist out there that are perfect.
Or like when I heard briefly that Facebook was considering charging for its use, I was like, good, because then everyone will stop using it. So I can stop having to use it.
Right. But like that's the thing, right? Is like there's not a solution. All of these intractable problems, the only solutions come from these sort of long, drawn out, understanding the nuances of every piece, and then bringing together a relatively unsatisfying response. Which, if I can wrap this entire show back to the very beginning of the show, that's partially why I'm so impressed with this deal with it for HFCs. Mm. Is because everyone isn't unhappy. Everyone is mildly happy, which when you're speaking of things which require such nuance and require such compromise on such a wide scale, if you get everyone who just isn't, there's that joke about how good compromise makes everyone unhappy. This is a monumental achievement to actually have people happy about an agreement that requires such nuance. And like when you're talking about funding in journalism, or you're talking about trying to inform the populace, these tensions are never going to – you're never going to have a solution where you read out and someone's going to be like, perfect, done. Walk the person beside you, we'll hate it.
Right. And just to close on an actual, because we spent more time than usual commentating this week, just to close on an actual news item, really good example of this I flagged this morning. I got an email from my list today. It happens to be from an environmental defense blog, but it's just reporting here that, we covered the Nestle issue a little bit. There was quite a lot of thing. Rick Mercer, who, despite him being deadly wrong on that one pipeline piece that we lacerated him over months ago, is generally on point, went after this as well. Now the Ontario Ministry of Environment and Climate Change announced a 2-year moratorium on all new and expanded bottled watering operations. So great, victory. Somewhat. They're in the article, if you want to read it, I'll post it as well. There's some qualifiers there. It's not perfect, blah, 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 blah. But here's the point. The government already knew what the law was. They were fine with it. The only time they stopped being fine with it is when people got really angry. The only reason that they got angry is because of independent journalism and organizations who pushed this information out, not because of the Toronto Star, not because of the Globe and Mail, not because of the National Post, because of places like us, people like Mike D'Souza, local ENGOs and larger ENGOs like Environmental Defense and some of these other websites as well. That's the only reason we got this change. And there isn't anybody who doesn't work for Nestle who shouldn't be happy about that, right? So just think about it. Even if you're somebody who catching this radio show on a station, you don't normally listen, you're not a fan of the show, you're tuning in, who are these crazy hippies? That was a win, and we got that for you. You're welcome. Time to go. Thanks so much for listening. You've been listening to this week's edition of The Green Majority. We're going to be back in just a minute with our bonus show, where Stefan will be joining us, and maybe not a special guest. We'll see, because I haven't asked yet. But there's somebody else here, and I'm pretending they're not, but they might be on the bonus show. Find out in a few minutes. Mystery. Thanks for listening to The Green Majority. Take care, everybody.